Let's call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record indicate that it is 1:35 p.m. on Friday, April 10th, 2015. Present today, we have Vice Chair Representative Sadler, Representative Edgman, Representative Gaddis, Representative Pruitt, Representative Wilson, Representative Guerra, Representative Guttenberg, and myself, Co-Chair Representative Thompson. Before we start, please turn off your cell phones because they interfere with the recording equipment. On today's schedule, we will have our second hearing on House Bill 137 and House Bill 15, and we will be taking public testimony on both of these bills. And if it's the will of the committee, I intend to move both of these bills out of committee. We'll also have our introductory hearings on House Bill 123 and House Bill 176. The first bill up today is House Bill 123, an act establishing the Marijuana Control Board relating to the powers and duties of the Marijuana Control Board, relating to the appointment, removal, and duties of the director of the Marijuana Control Board, relating to the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, and providing for an effective date. And this bill is at the request of the governor. Today we will be briefly introducing House Bill 123 and holding it for discussion and public testimony at a later date. Here to introduce the bill to the committee is Ms. Cynthia Franklin, the Division Director for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. Ms. Franklin, please come forward, and Commissioner, coming with her. Place yourselves on the record and introduce to the committee House Bill 123.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Chris Laddick, Commissioner Designee for Commerce. Thank you for the opportunity to bring House Bill 123, the governor's bill to create a marijuana control board, before you. This bill accomplishes two things. First, it's the vehicle for funding the marijuana initiative ballot, Measure 2. And as you're aware, when an initiative is passed by the voters, it does not carry with it any funding. It's up to the legislature to appropriate money to enact the initiative. Second thing accomplished in this bill is the creation of a board to regulate marijuana, which is an option left to the legislature in the initiative language. The administration spent considerable time reviewing a variety of options for the regulatory framework for marijuana, and due to fiscal and practical factors, recommends the options before you. It's a new five-member volunteer board with a shared staff with alcohol, meaning that while some additional staff is needed for the increased workload associated with implementation of the initiative and a new license pool, the cost of the board remains reasonable, $50,000 for the board travel and per diem. The cost is comparable to what would be required for the Alcohol Beverage Control Board to hold additional meetings to address marijuana regulations and licensing that provides a board solely dedicated to the responsible and safe regulation of the new industry. Cynthia Franklin, the director of the ABC board, is here to give you a sectional analysis of the bill and answer any technical questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, thank you for having me. My name is Cynthia Franklin. I'm the director of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. I'd like you to take you through the sections of the bill. Section 1 amends Title 4 by naming that the director of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board shall also serve as director of the Marijuana Control Board. It also amends the process for appointment and removal of the director to require a majority vote from both boards. Section 2 establishes the five-member Marijuana Control Board in Title 17 with designated seats for public health, rural, public safety, and industry. This is one of the sections that reflect the way that we wish alcohol was regulated, not the way the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board is currently structured. In fact, this structure for the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board is currently contained in Senate Bill 99, Title 4 revisions. There is no requirement for a public health or public safety representative on the current makeup of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. We feel that those seats are essential in this new industry. Section 3 establishes the terms of office for board members and the chair, sets out requirements for board meetings, and provides for board member per diem, outlines the power and duties of the board to propose and adopt regulations, establish qualifications for licensure, review applications for licensure, hear appeals from the actions of the director, reduce the area of a licensed premise, and adopt regulations according to AS 4463. Establishes the board's enforcement powers as mirroring those of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board as outlined in 4.06.110. Provides for the appointment and removal of the director and establishes the duties of the director. This section has the first change from the House Labor and Commerce draft. It puts into statute the intent that the Marijuana Board will meet immediately following the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board in order to reduce spending on staff travel. Section 4 defines the board in AS 1738-900 to mean the Marijuana Control Board created by this act. Section 5 defines director as the director of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board and Marijuana Control Board. It defines registration to mean registration or licensure as determined by regulation. Section 6 amends the duties of the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development to include providing clerical and administrative support for the Marijuana Control Board. Section 7 places the Marijuana Control Board on the list of entities whose hearings are conducted by the Office of Administrative Hearings. Section 8 provides for a sunset date. Section 9 amends uncodified law for the initial appointment of board members. Section 10 provides for transition regulations, such that if the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board adopts any regulations before a Marijuana Control Board is created, those regulations can be implemented, enforced, amended, or repealed by a Marijuana Control Board, and provides that the regulations adopted by the board in any transition period take effect after the effective date of this act. Section 11 provides for an immediate effective date. We're happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Franklin. Okay, we also have online, I believe, or yes, supposedly online, Chris Kennedy, the Chief Administrative Law Judge for the Department of Administration. Are there any brief questions from the committee? Again, these are trying to hold it down to be brief. We've got a lot of bills today, and this bill will be coming back before us for more discussion, more questions, and for public hearing, too. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Brief question. Ms. Franklin, sections 1 and 2 each include provisions for appointment and removal of the director. Can you explain the reason for the apparent duplication?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, Section 1 actually amends existing Title IV law so that the statutes regarding alcohol also indicate that the director of the ABC is simultaneously the director of the Marijuana Control Board. The other section addresses the same issue in 17.
Okay. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Just for the next hearing, the things I'm going to want a discussion on are this. Obviously, we're going to have enforcement when commercial marijuana comes online. And by the way, Ms. Franklin, thank you for all your work on this. I know this has been a heavy lift for you and taking a lot of your time. We're going to have enforcement when commercial operations start, but I'm of the opinion that until commercial operations start, we don't have to hire extra enforcement staff beyond the at least much extra enforcement staff beyond the police officers, troopers, law enforcement people we have on the street now, while we're not getting any revenue from marijuana. So I'd like to consider that. And the other thing is they do have to develop regulations. This whole sort of process where the Department of Law pretends to charge the ABC board for charges that from attorneys that already work there, I don't think that's a cost, and I want to question whether that should be in the fiscal note and whether the Department of Law really should be charging them for work that their existing attorneys are doing. Two things to possibly narrow down the fiscal note that I'd like to talk about.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. Commissioner, you had a comment about the enforcement officers not having to possibly hire two sets.
Yes, it's my understanding that the folks that are going to be hired will be cross-trained so that they can work together as they travel throughout the state. And there is an issue in between time before commercial operations that get started where we feel that there are going to be commercial operations starting and that those enforcement folks will probably be busy.
So they will be cross-trained where you won't have to send an alcohol enforcement officer and a marijuana officer out to a village. One person will be able to handle all of them. Okay. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe you can bring this back, but my question concerns the expiration date of the board is 2018. Just concerned that the amount of time to implement all the regs, write all the regs, implement them, is enough time for Ledge Audit to come back with something that actually reflects the real world and something not still in transition. So if you could come back with just the timeline of how these things happened and when, and get with Ledge Audit when they would expect to start the audit, and just to show us whether or not there's going to be time enough to do an adequate, for them to do an adequate job to give us a report.
Representative Gutenberg, through the chair, we can provide that timeline. The sunset date does match the current sunset date in the ABC extension bill. So they're matching sunset dates for both boards.
Yes, I understand. Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that. That might not be the best thing to do. That's what I want to make sure it is, that, you know, even though they're in some ways parallel, the initial audit period for the Marijuana Control Board might need to be a little bit different. That's all.
Thank you, Representative Guttenberg. Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you. Ms. Franklin, I want to ask a little bit about the membership. Four of them are pretty clear, the public safety, public health, rural, and marijuana industry. But it's that fifth person. For some reason, we have that the person is either from the general public or it looks like there can be a duplication of number four, actively engaged in the marijuana industry. But yet, as I continue to read in the section, I look down at E, it says you cannot have more than two members of the board that engage in the same business, occupation, profession. And if you move it over to F, a board member representing general public safety, public health, and rural, or the member's immediate family member may not have a financial interest in the marijuana industry. But yet, for some reason, we've got this kind of this either-or. So that fifth person, potentially, we could have two people that have a financial interest in the marijuana industry. I don't know, is that really our intent? Is our intent truly to have one person that's actively engaged in the marijuana industry and then that person to be from the general public? Why is the or there? Why do we have that potential duplication?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, the or is there because in satisfying those five designations, two industry members, public health, public safety, and rural, the background of the director is taken into consideration in this way. If the background of the director, for instance, would be a marijuana industry, if we fast forward into the future and someone who has marijuana industry experience is appointed as the director of the agency, then the marijuana industry would lose a seat on the board. If the background of the director is public safety, as my background is considered because I was a career prosecutor, then the public safety seat on the board would be replaced by a member of the general public. So it's a recognition that with a five-member volunteer board that only meets a few times a year, the background's director has a significant impact on the agency. And so it's an attempt not to duplicate background designations between the director and a board member. And so that replacement by a member of the general board of the general public would occur only if the director has one of the designated backgrounds.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. We will have this bill back next week to maybe list some questions if you have them, and we'll address them. Representative Guttenberg, did you have one final question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One person from the marijuana industry, there are different components of this industry. You know, it's like a distillery or a brewery has to be the same thing as a bar owner. So has that been taken into consideration? Have you talked about that?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, there's been a lot of discussion about the industry seat, particularly in the first 2 years when the regulations are being written and when we're coming out of an era when marijuana was a controlled substance. So we do recognize there will be different aspects of the industry, just as there are in the alcohol industry. What you do not see in this makeup of the board is a prohibition on any certain section of the marijuana industry having a seat on the board. There is a section to that effect in Title IV that prevents a wholesaler from having a seat on the alcohol board. So we have not identified any aspect of the industry that would eliminate a person from consideration for industry designation. But it is anticipated that there wouldn't necessarily be a way to represent all aspects of the industry on the board.
Commissioner, Ms. Franklin, I thank you very much. With Spill, we'll be back with us again next week for additional questions and public testimony. At this time, I'd like to set House Bill 123 aside. The next bill we will hear today is the introduction of House Bill 176, an act eliminating geographic pay differentials for employees of the legislature, repealing state employee salary schedule increases, and providing for an effective date by the House Finance Committee. It is my intention to briefly introduce this bill today, then hold it at this first hearing. We have a CS for this bill, version E. Representative Sadler, would you introduce the motion?
Mr. Chair, I move to bring CS for HB 176 Finance version 29-LSO796-E for ECHO before the committee for discussion.
Seeing no objection. Here today to present the bill to the committee is Ms. Jane Pearson, my chief of staff, and in the audience available to answer questions from the executive branch, we have Ms. Kate Sheehan, the division director of personnel from the Department of Administration. From the legislative branch, we have Mr. Skiff Lobaugh, human resources manager and legislative affairs, and from the courts, we have Ms. Nancy Mead, general counsel for the courts division of the Department of Administration. The departments are here to answer questions if necessary. And we have Kelly O'Sullivan from OMB also. Ms. Pearson, please come to the table, place yourself on the record, and introduce the committee to House Bill 176.
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Steve Thompson. And I'd like to walk you first through the changes in version E from the original version H that was introduced. We have taken out the geo differential, and the reason for that can be found in members' packets. There is a legal opinion that there could be problems with it. So this bill is now takes only the COLA, addresses only the COLA, which is scheduled to be at 2.5% increase of July 1 of this year. That will not be happening for state employees, for legislative employees, and for court employees. The COLA has been at different amounts over the years. It has been at zero. It has also been very high. Last year it was at 1%. And the savings from this will be approximately $9,296,100 annually for all branches of the government. And that's my introduction.
Okay, we have questions from the committee. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly understand the need for cost savings. My biggest problem with this is, as I recall, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but there was a three-year pay increase that was pretty minimal for a state employee. So it was 1% in the first year, as I recall, 1% in the second year, so lagged behind inflation both of those years. And the idea was in the third year, they would get something so that they were basically evened out with inflation over 3 years. And so they got their less than inflationary increases for year one, their 1% increase for year two, so 2 years in a row they fell behind inflation. And now this, as I understand it, takes away the 1 year where they're going to be able to be held even with inflation. And so I guess the question is, do I have those numbers right? And I guess if I have those numbers right, it just causes me some concern.
Ms. Pearson?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, you do have the numbers right. But as I've said, through the history of the cost of living increases, it's been all over. It has been as high as 4%, and it has been as low as zero. So.
Further questions from the committee? This bill will be coming back before us. We will have a lot more discussion on it and public hearing. At this time, I'd like to set House Bill 176 aside. Okay. Our next bill. The next bill up today is House Bill 15, an act relating to credits towards a sentence of imprisonment for certain persons under electronic monitoring by Representative Tammy Wilson. We have a CS for this bill. Representative Sadler.
Certainly. Mr. Chairman, I move that the committee take up CS for HB 15 Finance version 29 LS0102/S Sierra before the committee for discussion.
Seeing no objection, thank you, Representative Sadler. Representative Tammy Wilson is here to speak to her bill and walk the committee through the changes from former bill version G to the new CS version S. Representatives, please come to the table, place yourself on the record, and talk about the changes with the CS.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to Representative Tallarico for letting me kind of go ahead of his bill.
Thanks.
I'm not sure he agreed to that. Really.
Well, he does now, but thank you. So there's been two changes made. On page one, we took out the word substantial. So now it just reads that under electronic monitoring, and the court imposes restrictions instead of substantial restrictions on the person's freedom of movement. So we just took the word out, but the rest of it's in there. And on page two, section three, we added under electronic monitoring where you would have to request that the credit would be given 10 days before your disposition hearing. So those are the only two changes to the bill.
Okay, thank you. We also have available to answer questions on House Bill 15. We have Casey Schroeder from the Department of Law, Nancy Mead from the Courts, Carrie Belden from the Department of Corrections is online, Quinlan Steiner from Public Defenders Agency is also online. So we will now, questions from the committee. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For whoever is the appropriate place to answer this, where electronic devices are available, my impression is it's just Juneau, Fairbanks, and Anchorage, maybe on the Kenai, I don't know. But if you don't live in those communities where electronic monitoring is available, you're not eligible for this program. And the concerns of equal justice and the ability to have a same program in other places as well as the state. So if you're out in Bethel and the jail out there or need to be out there, you don't have the opportunity for this. So I'm wondering if there's somebody that has an answer for that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, the Department of Corrections does have this ability to be able to offer into those areas presently.
What
areas? So the private sector are not out in those areas, but if the chairman would like, we do have somebody here from the Department of Corrections, or we also have somebody on the phone. But they do have that available. They can do that currently.
Mr. Chair, is there somebody?
Follow-up, Representative Guttenberg.
It was somebody here from Corrections.
We have somebody in the room, Mr. Chair, if you'd like.
We have also online. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ramon Henderson. I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections Administration. Representative Wilson is correct. We do have electronic monitoring available in other communities than just the metropolitan. Carrie Belden is online to tell you what those additional communities are, if you like. But I will tell the committee that even in communities that we presently do not have electronic monitoring, the department is looking at expanding in other areas because the department would like to venture into putting more people on electronic monitoring to free up some hard beds.
Follow-up question, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it isn't available at this time. It might or might not be available at another time. For a significant part of this is this: these people are paying for this under this bill. The private, from what I understand, the let's say in Anchorage, the person with electronic monitoring is paying the toll for them to be on a monitor. How would you work that out with somebody in Tanana? I mean, and you don't have a fiscal note in to do that. I'm just wondering about what the cost is going to be for justice or for people outside of the metropolitan areas.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, this bill is dealing with electronic monitoring on pretrial. They're not the individuals that come under the jurisdiction of the department right now. We have a zero fiscal note because there's no cost associated for the department. But also, if you'd like, Representative Gutenberg, Carrie Belden, who is online, can tell you the other areas where the electronic monitoring does exist, because there are some. So there are a few other communities.
Okay, so in that answer to that question, just tell me pretrial. I just want to match it up with this bill. You know, I don't care if they're in corrections and on probation, but this is a bill about pretrial. So talk to me about pretrial and not about some what ifs where, you know, you're able to do that someplace else. So if we can get that answer, I'd appreciate it.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think I'm satisfied with the CS that it meets the intent of what we talked about the other day. So I don't have the amendment, Representative Wilson. So even though it's late in session, just for everybody listening, and I know that the representative doesn't care, but Gutenberg is the press and Gutenberg is the representative. So
I don't get any royalties, so that.
I do have a follow up to Representative Gutenberg's question. Two questions. First, the easy one. What does this cost somebody? Electronic monitoring. I know it's a pretty substantial cost.
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, for those people that are in DOC's custody that are on electronic monitoring, it is depending on what type you have. There are two types that we have. We have those that are alcoholic monitoring. We have those that are GPS. The alcoholic monitoring monitor is slightly more, but for the lesser is, I believe it's $14 a day plus a $10 a week for your analysis, so it's $108 a week.
And then through the chair.
Go ahead, Representative Garrett.
Thank you. And can you please tell me, I mean, there is an equal access to justice issue. So can you please tell me why, as the Department of Corrections, if the private company that's making money off of this says we want to be the vendor, that's great, but why couldn't you make a condition that they serve all of our courthouses so that people in rural Alaska have the same opportunity as people in the main cities?
Through the chair, I think I'd like the courts to answer that question.
Nancy Mead. If you'd come forward and place yourself on the record.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System, and I did hear a couple of the previous questions, but I'm not positive I heard the full most recent question.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Mead, and I'm not sure why it's the court system, but I'll take everybody's word for it that you're the right person. If we're allowing electronic monitoring, there's obviously a contract with electronic monitoring company, and they provide a good service and they make money for it, but we contract with them. Why can't we say, as part of the contract, you have to serve every community or at least most communities in the state? Why don't we use our bargaining power to say, if you're going to make money off of this, we want you to extend the benefit to people off the road system?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Guerra, first, preliminarily, the places that the electronic monitoring pretrial exists currently are Anchorage, Fairbanks, Palmer, and Kenai, and so not in Southeast. And then to directly answer through the chair, Representative Guerra's questions, we do not have any contracts with the vendors for electronic monitoring. The court nor the state, to my knowledge, enters a contract with the private vendor. What happens is the defendant, who has as a bail condition a third-party custodian, decides instead to hire the vendor to be their professional third-party custodian, and that isn't the terminology that's used, but that's the practical effect. And then that vendor is paid for by the defendant, and the defendant brings that person, the vendor, to the judge for approval as the third-party custodian. And then to hit your other question from previously, my understanding is that the cost for that can be somewhere in the neighborhood of $300 to $500, and it depends on how much monitoring you contract with the vendor for.
Mr. Chair.
Follow up, Representative Guerra.
But you're the court system, and the judges are approving this use. So they're number one, confirming that it meets their standards for safety and monitoring. Why couldn't the court system say, if you're going to do it in these communities, you have to do it in a bunch of other communities too?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I don't think that's ever been an issue or something that we thought about. The court has no professional relationship with the vending company. We don't go to their place of business. We have no contract with them whatsoever. In other words, it's just someone the defendant hires and says, just like when a defendant is told they need a third-party custodian, they might find their mother or sibling and bring the person in, and the court approves them or not. They just bring in somebody in a security guard uniform, and the court approves them or not. And I suppose what you might be saying is the court should say, I don't approve you because you don't also have an office in Bethel. That's just never occurred.
Representative Garrett.
And Ms. Mead, I think you also do good work. I think all of you folks do good work, but this is a new idea. I hope you would consider it because it is unequal access to justice, and the court has done a lot about equal access to justice over the years. And then finally, just so we're clear about this, this electronic monitoring doesn't go to somebody who commits the most minor crime and they're just released on their own recognizance, right? This goes to people who would otherwise get a third-party custodian, right? And a third-party custodian is somebody who basically has to be with the person 24 hours a day, tail them 24 hours a day, and if the third-party custodian doesn't tail that person 24 hours a day, then the third-party custodian could actually go to jail. So this is really, in practice, limited to people on third-party custody. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that's generally true, yes. People who are released on their own recognizance with no bail conditions obviously do not go out and hire a company to watch them because they don't need to, so they would not be covered under this bill. That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just so folks know, when you're just on the verge of being left in jail, basically we give you an out, which is third-party custody. It's for somebody who is not necessarily the most reliable person in the world in the court's eyes, but it does free up jail space, and I think that's a good idea if it's done safely.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. Next, we have Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess to piggyback on my colleague across the way there, what I heard the deputy commissioner say, and I guess here would be my question, is this bill necessary to, I guess what I heard him say is that they're attempting to free up hard beds, I believe that was the term that I heard, and is this bill necessary in order to do that and expand the electronic monitoring essentially statewide?
Through the chair, Representative Gaddis, at this point, the department is not granting time for electronic monitoring in pretrial. Do we have the ability to do that now? I believe we do. It isn't done right now. I believe that we do that. Is the bill absolutely essential for us to exercise that for those that are in our custody? No, not for the ones that are in our custody. But we're talking about individuals before they even get into our custody. I think that's what this bill is attempting to do.
And Representative Gaddis, through the chair, this is another incentive and another tool in the toolbox for the court system. What I am hoping with this bill is that people will be a little bit more incentivized to get the treatment that most need, pretrial versus sitting in jail waiting to see what happens. So that's the first and foremost. I hope that because now they'll be able to do that, and I'm sorry, Representative Guerra left, but but the whole thing is that, you know, to get that time credit is also an incentive, and what will happen is as now I get credit versus that I don't, those marketplaces may open up where you have a smaller portion of it because, of course, the private vendors are going to go to the bigger populations, but if they start seeing more that can now utilize that in the other areas, I would anticipate that they will actually go there. But I've been working very closely with the Department of Corrections, and they're doing a lot of changes, you know, in that area in trying to get that kind of help that we want to see people get.
So how long is the average amount of time that a person remains incarcerated awaiting in pretrial?
Mr. Chairman, That varies, and Carrie Belden, who's online, would be more able to answer that question, but it does vary. It could be a few days. It could be months.
Okay. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Mead, is there an issue with the equal access to justice here? Is somebody living in Bethel or another community saying, I don't have that available to me. I should have something available besides moving to Anchorage or Fairbanks. Is there a constitutional question?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I hesitate to say whether that's a constitutional question or not. I see your point, and it has been the case. It is the case currently that people in the communities that have vendors have this option available to them, and their incentive to use it is that they can be out of jail on an ankle bracelet instead of being in jail pretrial. That's why people use it in those communities. The fact that no vendor has found it to be, presumably has not just not found it to be economical to go to some of the other communities, is not something that that has caused the court to deny people from using these services in communities where it does exist. So I know I didn't answer your question, but I think it's a legal question that perhaps is best geared towards Ledge Legal or somebody like that.
We have Doug Gardner on the line from Ledge Legal at this time. Would you like to have him get on?
Mr. Gardner, did you hear the question?
I heard the question, Representative Guttenberg, and I got to say that I haven't.
If you'd place yourself on the record, please, Doug.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. My name is Doug Gardner. I'm Director of Legal Services for the Alaska Legislature. Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, we hadn't considered that question, probably because we're probably not logistically aware of. I mean, I've been listening to the conversation, but you know, in drafting, we probably aren't aware of where this service is available and where it's not. Does it rise to a constitutional level? Well, there's probably other things, other bail conditions that the court's able to order in urban areas that may not necessarily be available in rural areas, and I just don't know if it rises to that level. And I don't want to speculate about it. I will say, though, my experience as a prosecutor in trial courts and throughout Alaska is that courts try and adjust bail conditions to the realities of the communities in which people are being held in. And I think judges do a very good job, and they have a lot of opportunity to balance out bail conditions. I realize that's not a very direct answer to your question, but I guess in a roundabout way, I don't know that it rises to a constitutional level. I just don't know the answer to that right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner. Follow-up question, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. I mean, all things cannot be equal in the state from one community to another, from southeast to northwest part of the state. Ms. Mead, how flexible are the judges with the tools they have to administer something that would be, would somebody would say, something comparable in a community?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I don't know that I caught exactly the gist of your question. Maybe this is it. There are in statute a number of bail conditions. I want to say there might be 18 of them listed in the general bail condition statute, and then there are subsequent statutes that have special bail conditions for certain offenses. So if it's a DV offense, there's an additional two or three. If it's an alcohol-related offense, an additional few. A drug-related offense, an additional few. So if this was your question, the judges have a lot of choices when they're setting bail about what to set. And indeed, the last condition can be, or anything else that the judge thinks will adequately protect the community and protect the rights of the defendant.
Mr. Chairman, you are Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. I just learned something that now does trouble me, but can be fixed. There are, for people who have serious enough crimes that they're let out but with substantial restrictions, there's basically these two groups of people who are equal. The people who are going to get electronic monitoring, and we want to do what this bill says for those people and try and limit the amount of jail space needed. and to benefit people so they can go out and work, and I get that. For the people who cannot afford the electronic monitoring or who live in an area where electronic monitoring is not provided by a vendor, Bethel, let's say, they can't get the benefit of this time served because there's no electronic monitoring. So they go into something that's actually even more onerous, which is called third-party custody. They have to be with a responsible adult 24 hours a day, except for when they're at work or job training, follow them around, go to the grocery store, go to do whatever. And their limitations are actually a little bit greater than the person on electronic monitoring because they've got to be tailing that person the whole time. And I just learned they don't get this time served, the credit for time served. So now we are creating two classes of people. The people who can afford and do get electronic monitoring will get credit for time served. The people who can't afford it or live in a place where you don't get electronic monitoring don't get credit for time served. The very easy amendment would be conceptual to say, I mean, this is for people who have restrictions imposed upon them. That's the way the bill reads. But it would be to add electronic monitoring or under third-party custody that imposes restrictions on the person's freedom of movement. Otherwise, I think we are creating two classes of people. And frankly, if we go that way, we save even more jail space for two equal groups of people. And I think that's where you maybe minimize the equal protection issue.
Representative Gary, through the chair, there's a lot of classifications because, first of all, this is another tool in the toolbox. So this is not something that the judges say, you go do. It's something that can be brought forward by whomever has been charged. Again, I want to remind people that these people that we are talking about have not been found guilty to have done anything. Okay, so that's the first part of it. And second is that, you know, if you can't make bail, you may be sitting in jail. So we've already got a classification right there. So you and I could both go. We could both have to post $1,000. You have $1,000 because you make more money than I do. So I sit in jail and you don't. So that's happening currently. You know, so I just want to make sure that we realize that there's those issues out there to start with. We spoke about doing what you're speaking of at this point. When I come back in front of the judge and now I've been convicted of the crime, I need to now show them that I have done those things that I was sent to say that I did. With electronic monitoring, that's pretty easy because I'm going to have something physically that's ran off that can say that I didn't go where I wasn't supposed, you know, beyond the home. I only went to work. I only went to treatment. I have my certificate for treatment. When you get into a third party, you can have the person testify, and they're not going to be not telling the truth, but people do sleep. You know, or they may have to go somewhere else. And to be able to come to a judge and then say, I did all these things, and for sure, you end up with a whole lot of issues. I am truly hoping that having this incentive, we will see in many other areas of the state. And I think the reason we don't now is because you don't get credit for it. So I'm going to pay for something that keeps me out of jail, maybe, but I'm going to get nothing for it. And that really is the purpose of the bill, to incentivize not just so you have the bed space, as the department has said, but also we know that when you're in pretrial, very few things are available for treatment purposes of it because that's being utilized on those who are there. This bill can't fix everything, and believe me, I tried the first time, and it really didn't work. And so I would be willing to work with you on those other issues, but I don't think in this bill, I think what it will do is just make more issues that came with it, because as you see with all the people online, this has been a very cooperative portions of this to make sure that everybody could live with what's in this bill right now so that we could have that opportunity this next year to see if it works and whether or not we need to come back and make different kinds of tweaks because of what we learn.
We've been joined by Representative Kawasaki, and I forgot to mention that Representative Munoz is excused today. Further questions, Representative Edgman.
Representative Guerra asked the exact question that I wanted to ask, and maybe I'll just add to that question. Is there any scenario to Nancy down the road where we would actually include that category of offenders in this bill, third-party custodians?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, as Representative Wilson said, that is maybe something that could be taken up in the future. I guess until it's in the statute, the courts wouldn't give credit for that time. It would be a policy call on the part of this body, and then the court would apply it.
Representative Edgman, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Maybe to the person online with the Department of Corrections. Overall, in the future, we're going to see a lot more utilization of electronic monitoring, hopefully, across the spectrum. It'd really be interesting because I think that's one missing element of this whole discussion. If we could have the department to speak to that just for a couple of minutes, what do they envision in an era of downsizing budgets? I think this is, you know, maybe a greater tool that we're all going to be using.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, as I stated earlier, the commissioner is very interested in expanding electronic monitoring. He does not think that we've used it effectively. He wants to ensure that we expand it, but we expand it responsibly. It's just not going to be you're automatically, if you've committed a minor offense, that you're going to receive electronic monitoring. It's going to be done on an individual basis and done very, very responsibly. We are looking to expand it. That's one of the ways that vehicles that we see to eliminate the building of a new prison. We'll be looking at expanding electronic monitoring, as well as moving more people into the community residential centers.
How many people do we have at this time in pretrial waiting and they're incarcerated?
Right now we have, as of April 3rd, we had 1,875 people in pretrial.
Wow.
Mr.
Follow-up, Representative Edgman.
Yeah, that was part of the response I was looking for. The other part I was looking for is if there's a limitation on vendors, there's a limitation on electronic connectivity, there's things of that nature that are maybe out of all of our control at this point. And that goes to questions that Representative Garrett and others were asking.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, you're correct in that respect. And Carrie Belden, if she's online, she might be able to provide some additional information.
Carrie Belden, can you hear us?
Through the chair, yes. My name is Carrie Belden, and I'm the Director for Probation and Parole. And I hope I can clear up a few questions for you. We are limited in some of our coverage as far as across the state, but we are able to provide coverage through most of the state. And I believe if anywhere GCI has coverage, we can do electronic monitoring. And as far as the private companies for the pretrial, it would depend on their service provider and the tower availability and those technical aspects as to where they would be able to reach and what they would be able to do. And as far as it not being fair for some of the more rural places versus some of the urban places, we're limited by our technology. And if we could paint the brush and make it that we could offer it for everybody across the state, we could, but that's not something that's really in DOC's hands.
And as a follow-up, whose hands is it in then?
To the chair, I believe we're at mercy of the technology of some of these rural places don't have the coverage for the cell towers or the service providers that we can get reliable signals and be responsible in that community. Another concern is when someone does violate a bail condition, there's got to be some sort of law enforcement presence in that community to then possibly be able to arrest that person or rectify that violation. So that would be something that the court would have to take into account when they decide where people should be placed.
So, one more point. I don't want to prolong the discussion because I think the bill is good and needs to move on its way, but. I do want to look forward here a little bit. Is there a scenario where this is going to be routine? Electronic monitoring is going to be pre and post trial, I guess, going to be routinely used at all the regional court facilities, the Barrows, the Dillinghams, and so forth.
To the chair. Yes, you know, there is new technology that is rapidly developing, and I think it should be here hopefully in the next couple of years that we will have better coverage. And as that new technology comes down and those new batteries come down and we're not bound by our restrictions in technology right now, hopefully we will definitely be able to expand and provide a better service.
And then just one last quick question. Yes. So the availability of vendors isn't a limiting factor then? Private vendors.
I believe it's the availability for the cellular portion of it, where we get the signals and where we get the service towers. I think that's the biggest limiting factor for the rural areas.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say that yes. In an earlier version, Representative Edgman, we took out the word private for private residents to hopefully address to where, as long as it was a residence and maybe it was a halfway house, other places in areas that it wouldn't just limit to where your home was, because that was another way that we were able to address some of those more rural areas.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to that point briefly, the GPS element of an ankle monitor and electronic monitoring is just for location purposes. The communication between the ankle monitor and the authorities is through cellular telephones. Is that correct?
Through the chair.
That is correct.
Okay. So my question, actually, now I have the courts and corrections in front of me. My question is the one-to-one ratio of time on electronic monitoring be the same as time served in incarceration? Is that an appropriate ratio or is that too generous? I'd like to ask each of you in turn to give me your thoughts on that.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that's a policy call for the legislature, as the court often says, but I will say that the one day to one day is the ratio currently in statute for time spent pretrial in a treatment program. Currently, the only way you can get credit against your time served is to be in a residential treatment program with characteristics that resemble incarceration. And that's the 027 statute now that this would expand upon. That does call for a one full day to one full day equal time, if I'm saying that appropriately. I don't think I am.
I think you say it's our call, but in your opinion, there is some somewhat related precedent that if you're not in a locked treatment center, but if you're confined to, if you're directed to stay at a residential treatment center, the one-to-one. Gotcha. Thank you.
Correct.
And corrections.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I love that answer. I agree with that.
That was simple.
And Representative Sadler, through the chair, it's not any treatment program. It has to be a state-approved treatment program, and when you are confined to that treatment that you currently get the one-for-one pretrial, and that's the only way currently that you can do that.
In much the same way as the qualifications currently in the bill would say you would be confined to your place of residence unless you were attending a treatment center or job, et cetera, et cetera.
No, you may not leave the treatment center. If you leave the treatment center to go to other things, then that treatment days do not count. That's a whole other issue for another day.
Right. The point I'm making is that the one-to-one currently is for a confined treatment center, and your bill would require you to be confined to home with an exemption for going to treatment.
Yes,
so there is a component of restriction involved in that treatment center.
Representative Salisbury, correct.
Okay. Seeing that there are no further questions from the committee, I'd like to open up House Bill 15 for public testimony. Is there anyone in the room that would like to come forward and testify on House Bill 15? Seeing none, is there anybody online? Pardon? Only the questions that we've listed already. There's nobody else that would like to give public testimony on House Bill 15? Okay. Does the sponsor of the bill have any other comments?
Just thank you so much for your time.
All right, this brings House Bill 15 back before the committee for discussion. Yes.
Just one more brief question. I know the fiscal note doesn't quite say this, but I'd like to ask also the court and corrections, while this has not been presented primarily as a cost-saving measure, could you speak very briefly to what it would mean in terms of reducing costs?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, this would not reduce any court costs, any cost savings that you might see would not be with us. It's routine for courts to issue bail orders, and we would maybe do some modifications to our form orders, but that's inconsequential and something that we just do. And then it is also routine that we have at sentencings what are called either Nygren hearings or 027 hearings, where the people ask for credit, and there might be at the outset some longer hearings while the parties figure out just what the bill means, but we have no fiscal impact from this. This is fairly routine for us to apply.
Through the chair, Representative Sandler, at this point, we can't determine what those savings are, but we anticipate that there potentially could be some savings. Of course, it's more cost effective to be on electronic monitoring than it is to be in a hard bid. So, at $22 a day versus $152 or $150 cost, we think that potentially there's some room for some savings.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, in the packet we do have amendment number one. Representative Guerra. Withdrawing.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to offer a conceptual amendment on the point that
you're withdrawing.
I'm withdrawing amendment number one. Yeah.
Okay. We do have a conceptual amendment. Jane, you taking notes there too? Go ahead, Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to move a conceptual amendment that in this bill, if you're under the same restrictions as are defined for people under electronic monitoring, to get the credit for against your sentence, the same rules apply for people in third-party custody. If somebody's in third-party custody with the same restrictions that apply to somebody who's under electronic monitoring, I believe the same rules should apply. That's the conceptual amendment, and here's why.
Is there any objection? Object for discussion, Representative Guerra.
Here's why. The people who will be put on electronic monitoring are largely people who have some threat of escape, some threat that they're not going to return to court, some threat that they're going to be a danger to society, and we've decided that with electronic monitoring that's mitigated. And we have the problem of overcrowded prisons, and we're on the verge of having to build another prison, and we all know that. And we need to find rational ways to minimize the number of days we're using in prison, where as long as public safety is protected. So doing this with electronic monitoring makes sense, and we're going to reduce the number of prison days, and we're going to free up prison space and save money that way, and maybe be more humane at the same time. We should do the same thing for people who are under third-party custody, because they have the same restrictions on them, except instead of having an ankle monitor on them, they have a person tailing them around 24 hours a day. And the same purposes are served. You know, if the court says you have to go to school, get your GED, go to work, under whether it's electronic monitoring or third-party custody, the person has to follow it. And if you violate your bail condition, whether it's third-party custody or electronic monitoring, you don't get this credit because you're not allowed to commit a crime while you're out there, and violating your bail condition is a crime. So you've got two classes of people who are essentially the same. One class who can either afford electronic monitoring or lives in a community where electronic monitoring is available, and one group of people who have committed the same class of crime, but since they don't have electronic monitoring available to them, they have to find a 24-hour third-party custodian to tail them around. And that person, by the way, has to sign under oath that they're going to be with the person for 24 hours, or else they can go to jail. I think there's no difference between those two categories of people, and to think that we're going to have another bill someday, there's no third party custodian lobby that's ever going to come in this building and push a bill like that. So, Mr. Chair, I do ask for support for that amendment. I'm certainly happy to hear from the agencies, but these are equivalently situated people. But right now, the way the system works under this bill, and I'm sorry I didn't learn this till today, we will be benefiting those people only who can afford this and who live in a community that has it, and discriminating against those people who are in the same situation, don't have it available to them, and are under very similar and probably actually more restrictive conditions. So that's why I'm moving the amendment.
Okay. I've been a little remiss. I am closing public testimony at this time. So, bill sponsor, would you like to respond to conceptual amendment number one.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I do understand where Representative Guerra is coming from. And there wasn't even a lobbyist that brought this forward, you know, just to let you know. So I know, but I'm really, and the only reason I say that is because I really am committed to working through and making not just this work, but whatever else can as we bring everybody together. The reason I don't think it's the same is because you're not awake 24/7. And so to say that we're able to know the movement of the other person, you just really can't do that, as you can with electronic monitor, that something electronically is keeping track of where you've been and what you're doing. You know, unfortunately, a lot of times those who, you know, and I'm probably going to get in trouble for this, so, but a lot of times people who break the law know how to break it again. And so to think that as you fall asleep at 1 o'clock in the morning and you're going to have that person chained next to you, that's not going to happen. They're going to have their own bedroom. You're going to assume that they stayed in that bed and they didn't sneak out and go do something else. But you can't really say that for a fact, that you know where that person is 24/7. Where in this bill, by using electronic monitoring, that is part of what they will have to bring in to show the court system that they did do exactly what the court said, and they only went where they were supposed to go. And that's why even on the May on here, if they can't prove that, the courts don't have to give the credit unless they are convinced that they did that. So I just think at this point it does not match the intent of what I tried to do with this bill, to making it close to what it is jail and being able to prove that you really did do everything that you were supposed to do and kind of not keep that gray area in that. So for that, I am not in support of that, of this amendment.
Quinlan Steiner, can you hear us all right?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I can hear you.
Yeah, if you'd place yourself on the record and give us your titles, and I'm going to ask you what you think of this amendment.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Quinlan Steiner. I'm the public defender for the state of Alaska. I think there's two real questions I think being asked. One is this going to create a disparity or an inequity around the state for people who have money? My response to that is that inequity exists to a huge degree right now. People who have money can make the cash bail much more easily than people who don't have money. I think electronic monitoring and access to it actually reduces the inequity. It's easier to afford often the cost of electronic monitoring than the large bail that can be set. So there's also just general inequities around the state depending on what programs or treatment or options might be available. I also think that the existence of this statute would provide incentive for the expansion of this type of program to other communities. And I know that technology is getting more sophisticated. And as a result of that, I think there's some discussion that I heard that this might cause DOC to view potentially expanding their pretrial expanding into pretrial release, and I don't know how far along that discussion is, but I see this as promoting release and reducing inequities. And ultimately, because it can be linked to treatment, actually reducing recidivism. As it compares to third-party custodians, further reducing inequities, I think that would certainly be true. I think third-party custodians also serve a similar function, although they're not identical. But again, those are policy calls. But granting credit for third party would be a further extension of this general policy. But there are subtle differences between the two.
Thank you, Mr. Steiner. Representative Gaddis and Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I signed on to this bill with my colleague from Fairbanks. North Pole, I should say. Sorry, I corrected that real quick. Because I had folks back in my district that said the same thing. They said they've had folks, their kids specifically, that have had infractions, and there they are sitting in jail instead of working, instead of going to treatment centers. And quite frankly, if they're found not guilty, they've lost their job. They've lost sometimes families. If they're found guilty, at least they have an opportunity to inspire them to get off the wrong track, to get onto a track and move forward. Beyond the fact that it saves the state money, it saves families. It saves, it gives people an opportunity to kind of clean up their act. Now, should they choose not to take that opportunity? I mean, we can only give them as many tools, if you will. If they choose not to utilize it, I mean, I don't know how, you know, there are other things that I think the Department of Corrections can use. But that in mind, I think this is a good bill, and I'm concerned with the third-party custodian aspect, that it will bungle this up. I like the idea, and I would have to disagree to a certain degree with my colleague across the way, that I don't think it's onerous for the client that has the third party. It's really onerous to be that third party custodian. I mean, they're the ones that are giving up many of their liberties as they follow somebody around. But that being said, I think that this electronic monitoring, I think that moving forward, especially with a few days left in this session, I'm reluctant to do the third party at this time, because I think that it does bungle it up. I think there's a lot of work been put forward, and I like the Department of Corrections, kind of their attitude, if you will, having spoken to them, that I think that that is their goal, to move forward. So I hope that it passes out of committee and has the opportunity to go up and over to the other body.
Okay, Representative Guttenberg, on the amendment.
On the amendment, Mr. Speaker. I'm...
Oh, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. A definition, I'm going to ask for a definition of electronic monitoring. I know the amendment is on third party, but I just got on the app search, and there are electronic monitoring apps on iPhones and all smartphones. So there are available to anybody who has a smartphone or a cell phone, that they could have an electronic monitoring device on their phone. So what is the definition of electronic monitoring? Is it only an ankle bracelet?
Does the sponsor have an answer for that? And we are on the amendment,
right?
Not talking about electronic. We're talking about third-party inclusion.
Yes. Well, I think it's relevant to whether third party is relevant or not, or if you could expand it to anybody with a smartphone. So,
I wish I had an answer. I think we've been doing this ankle monitors, what they've been doing, but courts might be able to say what they've allowed since it's been pretrial, and what they would envision would probably be a clear answer.
I know Ms. Mead said before the judge has, and anything else.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, what I know has been allowed by judges, that is, judges have approved as a professional third-party custodian, companies that do put an ankle monitor on somebody with GPS active monitoring. They can put into the order certain exclusion zones. In other words, the company sitting in its office there on Brigaw, it gets a beep if the person goes into certain areas where they're not supposed to go, for example, the victim's home or, a school or certain perimeter around certain areas that might be problematic for that particular defendant. I know there exist also electronic monitors that measure alcohol. Those aren't used as much. So what I'm familiar with, what has been approved by the court, is an ankle bracelet with GPS monitoring.
So this is a GPS pretrial monitoring program. Would that qualify?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, it's all pretrial that's covered.
That's what we're talking about.
Yes, that's correct.
So theoretically, this device could be covered. A judge could order this device instead of an ankle bracelet if somebody's in Bethel.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, that is theoretically true. In fact, the court has approved as electronic monitors, as I say, just ankle bracelets that monitor with GPS that I'm aware of. In other words, I haven't seen where the court has said, okay, you're released on your cell phone as a monitor.
Okay. Representative Edgman?
Yeah, so the issue to me, I mean, I think this is an idea worth pursuing, but does it bog the bill down? And so can we hear from the court system whether or not this, is going to obstruct this bill in terms of where things are at, knowing that electronic monitoring is more at a formative stage overall than it is a fully developed stage?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, you're asking whether adding a definition of electronic monitoring would bog down the bill, or
no,
I'm sorry.
The amendment itself for third-party custodian credits.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I do maintain that that's a policy call, whether you want to add third-party custodian into that statute. If you did that, the court could apply it. I agree with Mr. Steiner and others who have said that there are differences between being under a third-party custodian arrangement and being on an electronic monitor with one of the vendors that the court knows of.
So just real quickly, I know our time is getting short here,
yeah.
But does the amendment at hand give the court system another tool to apply?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, Representative Edgman, I don't see that as giving the court another tool. Right now, the court can order third-party custodians, and so I don't hear the amendment or read the amendment as giving the court something else it can offer to people out on bail.
Representative Gaddis?
Well, I was going to get into the weeds with the app, and I've decided not to. I guess my comment is, if I have an app on my telephone, I can give that telephone to anybody, unless you strap that telephone to your ankle or wherever. I think we're getting too far into the weeds with our cell phone, but I see somewhere down the line. Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. For corrections in courts, real briefly, which is the most reliable indicator of information about a releasee's compliance with his release conditions? Does third-party custodianship give you less reliable information about compliance than electronic monitoring does?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I would have to say that an electronic monitor gives more reliable information about where somebody has been pretrial than a third-party custodian, but that can vary with the truthfulness of the custodian and other factors.
Thank you. And would you, if the corrections wants to say?
Do you agree?
No comments on that?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the person that's most familiar with the electronic devices is Ms. Carrie Belden, who's online. But I would tend to agree with what Nancy Mead said.
Okay. All right. Seeing no further discussion, is objection maintained or... conceptual amendment number one?
Yes, it is.
Nope. You didn't.
I'll object.
You can't object.
You're not paying attention. I am.
You can. You're part of the committee.
Yes, it is.
Let's take a roll call on the conceptual amendment number one.
Representative Gattenberg?
Yes.
Representative Kawasaki?
Yes.
Representative Pruitt?
No.
Representative Sadler?
No.
Representative Wilson?
No.
Representative Edgman?
Pass.
Representative Guerra?
Yes.
Representative Gaddis?
No.
Representative Thompson?
No.
Representative Edgman?
Yes.
Four yay, five nay.
By a vote of 4-5, conceptual amendment number one has failed. Okay, this brings HB 15 back before the committee. Any closing comments? Representative Wilson?
We've talked it to death.
Real briefly.
Brief question, Representative Sadler.
Actually, not a question, but a statement and a brief one. I can see that this recidivism we've seen is a big cost, and it's an issue that needs to be addressed. This is one tool in the toolbox to do so. I think it hits people when they are recently incarcerated, when they are most amenable to having behavior modified. It reduces their exposure to the potentially hardening aspects of incarceration. And I understand that it's optional on both the part of the incarceree and of the court system. So I think it's a pretty decent tool. I'll support it.
Representative, I'd like to entertain a motion at this time to move version S of HB 15 from committee. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd love to help with that. CS for House Bill number – I'd like to move, sorry, CS for House Bill 15, 29-LS0102/S with fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
From committee.
From committee.
As amended. Any objection? Seeing none, House Bill 15 version S as passed out of committee, and we'll take a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork. House Finance is back in session. The next bill on today's schedule is House Bill 137. Where did Representative Sadler go? An act raising certain fees related to sport fishing, hunting, and trapping, relating to fish and game conservation decal, raising the age of eligibility for a sport fishing, hunting, or trapping license, exception for state residents, raising the age at which a state resident is required to obtain a license for a sport fishing, hunting, or trapping, and providing for an effective date. This bill is by Representative Dave Tallarico.
Would you like me to move the work draft?
Yes, we have a CS for this bill. Representative Wilson, would you move the CS, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move CS for House Bill number 137, Finance 29-LSO625/G for discussion.
Seeing no objection, today we have Ms. Pearson, my Chief of Staff, to explain the difference between the CS version P and CS Finance version G. Ms. Pearson, place yourself on the record and explain the differences between the two versions, P and G.
For the record, my name's Jane Pearson, staff representative Steve Thompson. The first change can be found in the title, page one, lines 2 through 5. The Fish and Game Fund providing for the repeal of the sport fishing surcharge and sport fishing facility revenue bonds, replacing the permanent sport fishing hunting or trapping, what this does is say that the surcharge that was put on for hatcheries in Anchorage and Fairbanks, which is due to expire sometime around 2021, the $9 surcharge will now go directly on top of fishing licenses. You can see the effects in this in section 4, 9, 11, 13, 15, and 32. If you go to the last page of the bill, you'll see in section 34 that the revisers of statute will get notified when the bond is paid off, and the conditional effect that this will take, that this will be a conditional effect that will take place when the bonds are paid off in section 35.
And that is the total of the changes.
No.
You have more.
The next change occurs in the title.
I saw you going down. I know there's more.
Is in the title. We'll go to lines 3 through 5, and it has to do with replacing the permanent sports fishing, hunting, or trapping identification card for certain residents with an identification card valid for 3 years. What this has to do is with the senior card that is good once you turn 62 for life, you will now have to renew it. It will now have to be renewed every 3 years. It will not just be good for life. It'll still be free. The next change that shows in this bill will be on page 5, lines 1 through 4, and it has to do with the low-income license, and we have a slightly different way of accounting for this. It will be based on the most recent poverty guidelines by the state, set by the United States Department of Health and Social Services, instead of just being a number, and it will be for the previous year. The next change occurs on page 5 again. And has to do with the surcharge going up, and that would be on line 10. The next change occurs on the same page. It starts on line 31. It has to do with non-resident hunting and fishing licenses. There is now a 75% raise in those, so you can see that there's a difference. And that runs through that whole page. The next change occurs with non-resident alien big game tags, there is 100% fee raise on those. The next change occurs on page 9, which has to do with the fish and game conservation decal. It now reads, the $20 fee is subject to appropriation by the legislature. Money received under this section may be used by the department to fund programs benefiting fish and wildlife conservation. These programs may include fish and wildlife viewing, fish and wildlife education, and programs relating to fish and wildlife diversity. The next section is on the same page and starts on line 21 through 31. It has to do with the three-year senior renewal for their free license. And those are pretty much the changes that we made in this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Pearson. Okay, here is the sponsor of House Bill 137. Representative Dave Tallarico and his staff, Josh Banks, Joshua, and Representative, please come to the table and refresh the committee on House Bill 137. And before we start, I realize that it's already p.m. We have additional business that we have to get to this afternoon, like a conference committee on budget. So we're only going to run till 3:30, and then we're going to have to stop. I have this many people wanting to testify, and so we will go till 3:30, and then 9 a.m. Monday morning we'll be back for public testimony on the House Bill 137. So, yes, Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if it would help the folks who are waiting online to testify if they my sense is there is support to let the bill out of committee. I don't know if that might narrow the number of people who feel like they need to convince us to let it out of public testimony. I just didn't know whether that's worthwhile for you to mention.
Yes.
And I don't know if I'm reading the committee correctly.
We'll see how far we get by 3:30. Representative Tallarico, again, refresh our committee on House Bill 137.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. And I know you've known me for quite a few years, Mr. Chairman, so I won't go to my notes, so I'll be brief. House Bill 137, I was inspired to do this, Mr. Chairman, because it's about opportunity. And what that opportunity is for us to continue to enjoy the resources that we do have in the state and have the ability to participate in our hunting and fishing activities that we've done over the years. I guess what I would like to say is the committee had brought forth the CS and had recommended some changes, and I had the opportunity to look those over. And the combination of things that were put into the bill, I think, are very good, very appropriate. I do appreciate all of your work on that. And quite honestly, Mr. Chairman, I'm very happy with what has been presented here today with the committee substitute. And at that, unless there are any questions, Mr. Chairman, I will.
Okay. We're going to move to questions of the sponsor, but we also have people that you might want to ask questions of. We have Kevin Brooks, Bruce Dale, Tom Brookover, all from the Department of Fish and Game, available for questions also. Questions from the committee. Representative Kawasaki.
Thanks. Just a brief request. Because the fees did change, the spreadsheet that shows is really helpful to figure out what the current statute is versus different versions going through. So getting the updated one would be really helpful. Thanks. Mm.
Just made his head explode.
Figure it out.
Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, we can go to public testimony at this time. We'll open up public testimony. In the room, we have Mike Peterson. Peterson, place yourself on the record, and we'll hear your testimony.
Chair, committee members, my name is Mike Peterson. I live just across the way over there in Douglas. I'd like to speak to this working draft. I'm opposed to it as it currently stands, speaking specifically to pages 4, 5, and 6, the top of 6, where the resident and non-resident fees. I think there's room for more enjoyment in this draft. I think I would suggest that all of those resident and non-resident fees could be doubled, Mr. Chair. I will go down into Oregon and in the fall, and I'll hunt with my family, and I pay $148.50 for a non-resident hunting fee, and I've paid that for a few years now, and I don't blink an eye because that money goes into Oregon's coffers for keeping the games and up. And I look at these fees. It's been about 20 years since these fees have been raised approximately. It could well be another 20 years before these fees are raised again. I think in terms of the political capital that pulled together that got these numbers where they are, I think you can capitalize on that, and you can not only make up for the last 20, but you can also move ahead for the next 20. So that's my recommendation, Mr. Chair and committee members, to take these non-resident resident fees and just double them across the board. That's what I'm speaking towards. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Next in the room we have Mitch Falk. Mr. Falk, if you'd give us your name and your...
My name is Mitch Falk, also from Juneau. I'd like to say that I support your efforts of what we're doing here. We do need to start raising money for our fish and game efforts. I also am not very happy with how we have written this, or I think our lack of participation. I think residents should be included in this also. We're leaving a lot of money on the table through the Pittman-Robertson funds. We pay those taxes. Everybody across the country pays those taxes on all sporting goods. And if we don't use them, other states do. For every dollar raised, it's a 3-to-1 matching fund. For the price of one of these, which one teenager with the munchies can consume in a few minutes, you might be able to just get a tag, pay $10, get a moose tag, go get 400 pounds of meat, give the opportunity to get 400 pounds of meat. I think that that's not too much to ask at all, and that $10 brings in $30. Also, on the issue of the lifetime licenses, most of the people I know that are in their 60s have a lot more money than the people that are 25. I'm not so sure that time hasn't come to maybe sunset those, just like the longevity bonus. I know it's a hard thing to do, but as a state, we are getting older, finally, and I think it is time to move on from that. I've been told there have been 87,000 of those licenses issued. If nothing else, if we charge a $10 renewal fee every 3 years, I don't think that's too much to ask either, especially in a state where we're given a big chunk of free money every fall. I think that's about all I got to say.
Thank you very much, Mr. Falk. Okay, next I have a different request. Ron Arno, are you online? No? Okay, I had a note here that said that Mr. Grasser and Ron Arno wanted to testify together, one online and one in person. But okay, we're going to move on down the list. Eddie Grasser?
Mr. Chairman,
yes, sir.
My name is Eddie Grasser with Safari Club International, and actually, since Rod's not on the line, we have Ron Somerville from Territorial Sportsman, who's part of our coalition.
Go ahead and place yourselves on the record.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Eddie Grasser. I represent Safari Club International Alaska Chapter. As some of you may have heard, a broad coalition of outdoor groups throughout the state of Alaska have come together in support of an increase for fish and game licenses and tags. We've been working on this for some time now. We really appreciate Representative Tallarico's willingness to introduce the legislation to get this started. I'm going to give a little brief history of this issue, and Ron has most of the details. Maybe some of you know this, maybe some of you don't, but America has one of the best wildlife conservation programs in the world. It's called the North American Model for Wildlife Conservation. It was actually instituted by people like Teddy Roosevelt, Gifford Pinchot, and George Bird Grinnell, Otto Leopold. The unique thing about it is that we created a user pay system. And this isn't the first time that the users have come before our legislative body to ask for an increase or to institute a license fee or tag fees. That has been the case throughout the history of this program. For instance, in 1937, sportsmen were able to talk Congress into creating the Pittman-Robertson Act or the Wildlife Restoration Act. This is during the Great Depression when sportsmen came before Congress, when most people didn't have nearly the money that we all have today. And they got Congress to pass a tax on rifles, ammo, and other sporting gear to pay for wildlife conservation. We got together early this year, and in the spirit of the North American model and the pioneers of the conservation movement in America, drafted what we thought were reasonable increases to license fees, tags, and other issues within the scope of fish and game management. Although we support Representative Tallarico's efforts, I would have to agree with the two gentlemen that have already testified. It's our concern that those do not go high enough to capture Pittman-Robertson money that's available to us, nor will they capture future dollars from Pittman-Robertson. We're leaving a lot of money on the table here by our calculations, money that could go into creating situations that provide opportunities for Alaskans to fill their freezers and for people like registered and master guides in Alaska to conduct business. We would hope you would seriously consider bumping those fees up a little bit, as been suggested by the previous two speakers. And with that, I'm going to turn this over to Mr. Somerville.
Somerville, if you place yourself on the record, we'll hear your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ron Somerville. I live here in Juneau, and I'm a member of the Territorial Sportsman here in Juneau, also a member of the Alaska Outdoor Council, by the way. I'll just add a little bit to what Ed said. There was two proposals to start out this session, and one of them, they were distinctly different, but one thing, they were similar, and they were looking for a certain amount of money, in essence, to match the general fund monies that would, we are predicting, and I think you would agree, will disappear from sport, fish, and wildlife. Right now, they have about $12 to $13 million still in those two divisions of general fund money. When I was deputy commissioner in Department of Fish and Game, when the Hickel administration came in, I was responsible for budgets, unfortunately, and we lost every cent of our general fund money from those two divisions. When they compete against Comfish, other programs, health and social services, whatever else you people look at and have to fund, they become a lower priority. So the sportsmen are saying, what Mr. Grass has just said, is we want some of these programs to continue, and we're willing to pay for them. And that's the guts of this. So, but when we started out, there was one distinct difference. One is, although the funding total amount was about the same, one of them had resident tag fees, and we got together and cited, and I think we talked to a lot of legislators that was not going to sell at that time, although most states use resident tag fees. We decided instead to go ahead with a fairly sizable increase in license fees for both residents and non-residents, plus a new concept called an intensive management surcharge of $10 for all hunting licenses. And that would essentially terminate in 3 years or sunset. If I may, I'd like to, I have two graphs quickly to illustrate what I'm trying to say here and what Ed has referred to. The first one is a graph showing PR, Pittman-Robertson monies, that are the federal monies available on a 3-to-1 matching for wildlife. And if you look at the graph, you'll see that the obligated money, the obligated money for fish and game was not enough to match all of the federal money. There was about $10 million of federal money still laying on the table. And if, and all with all respect, there's a good chance that similar amounts going to be there this coming year. So we were also looking for the possibility of projecting into the future. That's why we're making a pitch that we too respect what Representative Tallarico has presented as an option. We feel we've got to go higher in terms of how much money we can generate. The other graph I'll reference in just a second. And that's how we got where we are. We've consistently said from the beginning, here's the amount of money we want to generate, and here's how to get there. There's a lot of things that federal aid is not capable of funding. For instance, predator control. The legislature passed a law called intensive management requiring the department, where possible, through habitat manipulation, control of predators, and any other means, to put the emphasis on producing more game, particularly moose and caribou, for harvest by Alaskans. And the department has done that. And I think you'll see in the second graph, or the map, which shows the present predator control program. That's not all of the intensive management program, but that's where the predator control programs are located. And the other things that federal aid will not fund is a lot of the conflicts we have with endangered species, which relate to a lot of the economic development and concerns that this state has about the expansion of the listing of endangered species in the state. A lot of that cannot be funded by federal aid. The regulatory process, very complicated in Alaska, 80-some advisory committees, two boards, Board of Fish and Board of Game. Most of what we do there cannot be funded by, except the gathering of data, cannot be funded by federal aid. Information education programs cannot be funded by federal aid. The federal overreach conflicts we have in this state, which I myself have been embroiled in as well as you people have, and that is more and more problems with the federal government attempting to take away some of the things we were promised to statehood. A lot of things that Fish and Game does in that arena cannot be funded with federal aid. The ANILCA implementation programs in the state cannot be funded with federal aid. My point here is we've got to generate enough Fish and Game Fund money to pick up some of these critical programs. And what is in the present bill will not do that. Again, with all due respect to Representative Tallarico, I'm going to finish up by saying if you look at that map of the predator control program, the thing that's critical here, this is not an urban versus rural area thing. The Board of Game, which I served on there when we started in Unit 19 in McGrath, the Intensive Management Program has expanded to what you see there. The predator control programs have been very successful in some areas. Less successful, I will say, in others, but still has produced more caribou and moose for Alaskans to eat than we had prior to the start of that program. And one of the examples is Unit 9. The feds wouldn't allow us to control wolves in their areas. We had to use a calculated change, if you will, in the process, but they were able to, in essence, stop the decline of that caribou population. Anyway, I would ask one thing. If we can't generate enough money, I want you to help tell us and tell the department which one of those programs you'd like to see disappear and in what order, because they will disappear, because all right now they're funded by general fund monies. We're going to have to generate more Fish and Game Fund monies to pick those programs up, and I apologize for the extended comments. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Somerville, thank you very much, and Mr. Grazer, thank you very much. We appreciate having everybody here present. Yes?
I have questions for the two.
Okay. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first gentleman who spoke talked about raising the non-resident fees. It looks like the original Outdoor Caucus suggestions were much higher. There's case law in that was in the bill packet talking about the level. It talks about, for instance, that you can, in fact, charge non-residents more than residents, and there's quite a few case law. It talks specifically about resident fee to take elk when compared to non-residents. Non-residents pay 25 times more than a resident would for a fee. I'm curious if you have some data or background, because I know you guys that hunt outside of the state, if these numbers are similar or in line to what they do in other states.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, the organization I represent does have offices throughout the United States, and a lot of our members travel. And actually, there are states where the resident non-resident ratio is far greater than 25-1. For instance, for a non-resident mule deer in Arizona, it's $2,500 just for the tag.
Does that answer your question, Representative Kawasaki?
So I mean, I'm just it does. You know, if we're going to chart, this is off version P. It's the resident hunting suggestion was to go to $40. The non-resident was $125. So that's roughly four times more, or three and a half times more. I guess that may be something to consider. And then second, through the chair. If there's groups out there that think that adding to the non-resident tags or fees will suddenly chill the amount of tourists that come up or tourist hunters that come up here, if you can comment on that. Thanks.
Okay.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, as long as the raises for non-residents are reasonable, having been a guide myself for over 30 years, I don't foresee that as being a roadblock to their participation in our hunting activities here in Alaska. But another person that signed up to testify today, Thor Stacy from the Alaska Professional Hunters Association, could probably answer that question better than I, because he's currently guiding.
Thanks.
Okay. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Grassard, I'll leave my struggle on the sort of resident fee increases to the side. I understand the arguments, and I've got to sort that out myself. But on the non-resident fees, I did run through a number that seemed, the increases seemed pretty low. Do you, for the non-resident fees, have a proposal for what we could increase the fees to without, and get a net gain, right? So we're not raising them to the point where people are going to hunt less or fish less and we lose money?
Well, sticking with the coalition's template for what we'd like to see accomplished, we were suggesting 100% increase in non-resident tag fees rather than the 75% that's before you in the current CS. So basically doubling every single one. So, for instance, a brown bear tag would go from $500 to $1,000. If you're asking if it could go higher for brown bear, probably. Some species, maybe not so much. You have to remember that we have other destinations in North America that people can go to. So if you go too high, they're going to go there instead of here. For instance, you can hunt Alaska Yukon moose, caribou, grizzly bear, doll sheep, and mountain goat in British Columbia and Yukon territories.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we're going to move down the list to the next person. We haven't got a lot of time left. Matt Robus. Please place yourself on the record, and we'll hear your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Matt Robus. I'm a resident of Juneau, and this is my personal testimony, but I am a member of the Board of Directors of the Territorial Sportsmen Incorporated, which is a local sportsman's group here in Juneau. And as well, I had a 27-year career with Fish and Game, ending up from 2003 to 2007 as the Director of Wildlife. So I see the funding puzzle here from that perspective. In my opinion, at the very least, the increases in this bill need to account for the inflation that's occurred since the last fee increase, license and fee increase in 1993. That amounts to a 63% correction. In other words, a $25 resident hunting license in 1993 is worth $41 this year, and we're still collecting $25. The proposed increases in the current CS and in version P are below that level, well below that level. And I think it's true to think that we're not going to see another chance to increase revenue to the Fish and Game Fund for another decade or two. And to not even catch up with inflation, I think, is a substantial problem. The second point I'd like to make is that the department needs to have sufficient money in the Fish and Game Fund to match all of the federal aid money, the Pittman-Robertson on the wildlife side, Dingell-Johnson money on the sport fish side, in order to be able to maintain the heart of the survey and inventory programs that allow the department to recommend to the boards how they're going to set seasons and bag limits and preserve as much opportunity as possible for Alaskans and non-residents who come up to enjoy our wildlife resources. If we leave Pittman-Robertson money on the table, as Mr. Somerville said, that money has been increasing radically in the last couple of years and is projected to increase again in the future. It would have the effect of not gathering money paid by sportsmen and other people who purchase sporting gear and firearms. It's not federal money. It's administered by the feds, but it's money that we outdoors users, resource users, deserve to get back in order to be able to use for management. At a time when the state is really having some financial problems, the federal aid monies would be a real boon, would continue to be a real boon to the state. And so I think that this bill needs to be set at a level that's going to enable the state to grab all three of those dollars for every dollar we put up. Also, as Mr. Somerville said, in the early 2000s, when I became director, we had virtually no general fund in our budget in the Wildlife Division. That has now gone to where 13% of the sport fish budget and the wildlife budget are composed of general fund monies. That general fund money is probably going to disappear and yet the jobs that the legislature has mandated that the department do, such as intensive management, are going to be left without the horsepower to get them done. Finally, I'd like to briefly re-mention, it's been said before, but the ability of the state to deal with endangered species initiatives and petitions, some of which are either frivolous or mischievous, is a real cost, and it's really difficult for the state to defend against them without being able to do research to prove our side of the argument. So basically, in the last moments, I'll say I think that this is a unique moment. I think that you have an unprecedented coalition of outdoor-oriented people, non-residents, residents, viewers as well as hunters and fishers, and they are all asking through many, many organizations in this coalition to have their fees and license and tag fees raised to the level that is shown in the letter that I believe you have in your packets from the coalition to the co-chairman of this committee. And that's the level that we feel is appropriate to fund the department to properly do its job and provide wildlife and fisheries opportunity to Alaskans and our non-resident visitors in the future.
We need to announce that we're going to go till 4 because I told you we're going to talk.
I guess that's all I had for today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Robus. Co-chair Thompson has left. He's leaving. He's got another meeting to go to, so I'll take over the chair for the remainder of the meeting. We had announced we're going until 3:30, but we're going to extend public testimony this meeting until 4 p.m. with the members' agreement. And we'll continue moving around the state to get testimony record, and we'll hold this and bring it up again on Monday. So for that, I'd like to continue to hear public testimony. We'd call Doug Larson to the table. And while there's no formal time limit on testimony, certainly I hope that those testifying will respect the time constraints we have and make your point. Just give us your name for the record, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. For the record, my name is Doug Larson. I live in Juneau. I've enjoyed the privilege of hunting and fishing throughout the state for many years. As Mr. Robus, I served as the director of the Division of Wildlife Conservation. My tenure was during 2007 to 2010, and as a result of that, I have a pretty good feel for an understanding of the budget challenges that the Division of Wildlife Conservation faces. I understand the past importance of the general funds, the CIPs, that the legislature has graciously provided the division to do the programs that they have in place, including the standard survey and inventory work, intensive management, and then the research, as has been indicated earlier, to prevent endangered species listings, all of which is very costly. I support the coalition's proposed rates and feel that the amounts in the existing bill are insufficient, as others have testified to. I've heard there may be concerns among legislators about not wanting to raise resident fees too much. I can certainly appreciate that. As a resident, I appreciate that. However, if you look at the resident non-resident fees and contributions, non-resident hunters have historically made up about 20% of the hunters that come to Alaska each year. However, they contribute about 75% of the funds to the Fish and Game Fund. Residents, on the other hand, make up about 80% of the hunters in Alaska each year, but they contribute about 25% of the funds to the Fish and Game Fund. And a similar relationship exists with the sport fishing fees. Now, this isn't so much a reflection of inappropriately high non-resident fees. And in fact, as you heard from Mr. Grasser and others, compared to other states, Alaska is pretty reasonable in that regard. Rather, it's a reflection of inappropriately low resident fees. That's why I'm supporting the fee increases proposed by the coalition. I retired last October from the Department of Fish and Game, and my income is now less than it was while I was working. Nonetheless, like many other Alaskans, I'm willing and prepared to dig deeper into my pocket to pay a higher amount to ensure that programs like survey and inventory, intensive management, ESA, and access defense remain viable. This is not the first time I think it's important to note that this fee increase idea has come forward. Efforts were contemplated during Mr. Robus's tenure and during mine, and more recently during Doug Vincent Lang's tenure as director. However, as has been noted, up until now we couldn't find agreement among the user groups. And at this point, there is strong support for a higher both resident and non-resident fees. And in my mind, as Mr. Robus said, this is a huge difference from what we've faced in the past. Mr. Chairman, I think it's important to make a quick note about the IM surcharge concept. I'm not sure whether IM surcharge is the correct terminology to use, quite frankly. I know that some people get very anxious when they hear the term intensive management, just like others get anxious when they hear the term conservation pass or decal. The reality is that funds that go into the Fish and Game Fund will and should be used for survey and inventory, intensive management, and wildlife diversity. And intensive management is a broader application than just predator control. It involves habitat assessment, predator prey assessments to determine whether, in fact, predator control would even be a useful way to increase populations, as Mr. Somerville related earlier. The state receives $2 to $3 million annually from federal state wildlife grants funds. Those funds, like Pittman-Robertson, must be matched by state funds. Absent sufficient GF or CIPs, that means a need for more GF funds, which means sufficient increases in the fees. Money deposited into the Fish and Game Fund from a conservation pass or decal can be used to match state wildlife grants dollars. In the past, SWIG dollars were matched by state funds to conduct research on a variety of unhunted species and has been successful at preempting ESA listings. And examples include yellow-billed loons, black oyster catchers, bats, kitlets, merlets, stellar sea lions. More recently, funds are being used to study Southeast Alaska wolves to inform a petition to list the species as threatened or endangered under the Endangered Species Act. Listings of game or non-game species have huge implications for hunting and trapping, as well as for mineral and oil exploration and extraction and timber harvesting. Obviously, huge economic implications. Mr. Chairman, the last thing I want to highlight is I had the privilege a few months ago to serve on the governor's transition team for wildlife. And while we had a number of individuals that came to the table with very different opinions about things and backgrounds, the thing was that there were several points that there was consensus and agreement on. And that included the need to increase and diversify revenue to the Division of Wildlife Conservation specifically. It was a wildlife committee. And the conservation pass that has been contemplated is a way to do that, to diversify and bring other users into the fold to help with the funding. Also, the group said that there was a need to expand and enhance intensive management, and specifically expand intensive management aspects not just for predator control, but for habitat assessment and to look at the predator-prey relationships that are so important to that whole program. And that's what intensive management entails. That's where the concept of an IM surcharge or a wildlife conservation surcharge or something to that effect could be very valuable, and that's the reason for its inclusion in some of the discussions that have occurred relative to the fee increases. Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to offer testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. And I did notice you looked like you were referring to notes. If you'd like to leave those written comments with us, that'd be helpful for our reference. So,
happy to do so. Thank you.
Or if you need to retain a copy, we can get a copy. Thank you very much. Next, we have before us Thor Stacey, if you can come up and... And we have about half an hour to go and about 25 people, so... some of the folks who are off-net are not likely to get to testify. We'll come back Monday, but we'll get through whom we can. Mr. Stacey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Thor Stacey. I live here in Juneau, and I represent the Alaska Professional Hunters Association as their Director of Government Affairs. I'll be very brief with the time constraints. The Alaska Professional Hunters Association represents hunting guides here in Alaska. Alaska's hunting guiding industry is approximately an $80 million a year statewide industry. Fully half of those economic effects are felt in rural Alaska. 89%, but according to the recent McDowell report, but 90% of Alaska's active hunting guides are Alaska residents. However, 95%+ of our clients are non-residents. As part of the coalition of sporting groups, we're comfortable supporting 100% increase in non-resident hunter license and tags. But as Alaska residents, we're very comfortable in supporting at least catching up with or slightly exceeding the inflation rate from 1993 until now. As guides, we have to buy both a resident hunting license and purchase a professional license every biannually. So there's two main concepts at the core that our group participates in continuously. One is federal oversight and overreach. We deal with federal land managers continuously. Without an adequately funded Department of Fish and Game, without the ability to exert our role as stewards of our resources and land and ownership of the animals here in Alaska, we fall victim to federal encroachment and the idea that the feds exert more and more management authority over our resources. The second issue is that without the ability to self-fund wildlife programs, without sportsmen having that ability, without the ability to pay fees, which this body is in control of, we're asking to pay more money for wildlife. Essentially, we're at the mercy of other factors that contribute to the general fund, the largest one being oil taxation. Our concept is that we would like good, sound wildlife management to be able to continue regardless of oil flow down the Trans-Alaska pipeline or regardless of oil prices. So by supporting the higher increases as part of the coalition amounts and adequately funding these programs, sportsmen have the ability to isolate our programs of wildlife management from the vagaries of oil production and oil price.
Thank you very much. If anyone's got questions, certainly leap in, but otherwise we'll go to the Fairbanks LIO, where we have Mr. Albert. Al, if you're there, can you hear me? Go give us your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Al Brett for the record. I reside in Fairbanks for almost 30 years. I would, first of all, I would like to say that I'm opposed to the way this bill is currently written. I would like to address what was said on record to what I read. It was said that on page 4, section 10 was going to be the current draft or current proposal, but on page 5, section 11, which is line 8, it says this amendment by section 10 of this act is amended to read. And so what I'm reading is that you're going to have the 29,800 poverty level line with the gross income versus what was said on record that you were going to take the household and equal and take the word gross out and take the word and take the poverty line out. Is that true?
Goodness, I'm going to have to ask the bill sponsor to help speak to the differences between the versions and the references. Is that a clean reference there, Representative Tallarico or Josh? If you want to just restate your question, Al.
My question was, what was said on record was they were going to eliminate Section 10 was being amended by Section 11.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Joshua Banks, staff to Representative Tallarico. And we did notice that as well, looking through this CS. And I'm not sure if that might have been a drafting error, or but our intent was to have the language in under Section 10. So that may be a possible conceptual amendment, Mr. Chair.
Your intention is to have the language in Section 10 remain?
Okay. Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Let's make sure and identify versions and so forth before just a... Okay. Mr. Brett, does that answer your question?
Yes, I'd like to continue. Because I didn't know where I was going to lead in my testimony.
Okay, fair enough. Correct. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. great. I'm glad that's cleared up. I would like to say that I've only left this state 3 times in 30 years that I've resided here. I've only hunted outside once. So I don't know about affording to go outside and hunt anywhere else. My income is very limited. I could probably safely say my income's lower than anybody in that committee or in that room. So you got to keep in mind, you know, the middle, low income or low middle range Alaskans also. I looked at this concept of raising licenses for 2 years. I think a lot of these NGOs and even the representative who I really like and support a lot looked at these possibly 50 licenses that we can currently sell or purchase in this state, and they've looked at it with real blinders on. I would like to bring to note that we have many licenses sold for $5 or less, waterfowl, low-income, drawing hunts. It costs the department roughly $2 just to issue and produce these licenses, so it's only a net of $3. I think you got to start looking at those types of licenses. We haven't talked about drawing hunts, and I just mentioned it. You know, most of our drawing hunts are $5 and $10. We need to, again, it's costing us $3 or $2 just to produce and issue these licenses. I mean, is this going to be another barge the bar in the barge or the cafe down in the legislative office there, that, you know, we're subsidizing licenses that are too cheap. We need to at least make, you know, break even or make some money on these. I would like to give two examples of how I can increase almost $1 million in just by reviewing the numbers of these new proposed fishing licenses. I'm talking about non-resident 1-day, 3-day, 7-day, and 14-day licenses. Excuse me. If you just take and eliminate and set aside the 1-day fishing, non-resident fishing license, because that's the most popular license sold in Alaska, and you would combine the 3-day, 7-day, and 14-day license and their current fees and average that new cost out, it would be $45. And you take the 3-year average of those licenses sold, I could increase your revenue by $513,000. If I did the same exact formula to the king salmon stamp, had a 1-day king salmon stamp and then a 14-day king salmon stamp, the only two choices you get, average that cost out, and that would come to a $50 king salmon stamp for a 14-day hunt. I would net $465,000 to the state. And if that $50 was a little high, we could drop it down to $45. That would be a $225,000 increase. So virtually just looking at two sections, and I've done this for over 2 years now, or go right at 2 years, I'm sorry, I can find millions of dollars without even looking at what this proposal does. There's many others. I think you should really consider low income. You know, that's a $5 license costing us $2 to produce, and, you know, we're issuing 3 licenses to a low-income person. I think the first person that testified that had a pizza box or something there, even myself, I can afford a pizza every now and then. You know, I could see at least, you know, a $10 or $20 increase in that license in itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I will let it go at that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Barrett. Appreciate your comments. Going next to your friend in Fairbanks there, Mike Tinker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Am I coming through loud and clear?
Yes, sir. Try and be cognizant of the time, though. Go ahead, Mike.
Will do. My name is Mike Tinker. I live in Esther, Alaska. I'm representing myself and my family today. Although I retired from a 25-year guiding career in the year 2000, I've been a member of the Fairbanks Advisory Committee for over 25 years. One of the things I'd like to say, just to keep the record straight here and not to cause any conflict, that I support, and most of my colleagues here support raising license and tag fees. However, there are some black holes in this thing, and I think what you should do with this is use it as an opportunity for other changes and looking at the whole picture. The coalition that has come together to push this thing is relatively similar to the coalition that has been asking you to do something. I really applaud Representative Tallarico's effort to come forth and do this. But there are some focus issues here that are important. For example, you're going to need a change in Alaska 1605-130D in order to keep the concepts that Mr. Somerville and Mr. Larson talked about, because right now we have a requirement that license fees directly benefit the user. And the department has been called on the carpet several times over the years because of the fact that they get into some of these studies and research and non-game type of things, and they're not benefiting users. This legislation affects over 250,000 Alaskan licensed buyers, and your coalition represents about 4% of them, the NGOs and your previous directors that you're talking to. So please make some room for the other 96% of us. For example, reference today is the 84 advisory committees out there, most of whom, like the Fairbanks Committee in discussion on last Wednesday night, were waiting for this bill to finally settle and be something that we could actually take a look at, because we did some work early, and I did for Representative Tallarico. We did some organizational work. We did some comparative analysis and realized that we really can't get all the way to where we want to go with regard to extinguishing GF, and that an explanation needs to be out there to support this bill that says we're going to try to get some of that, but we're going to try and make the department healthy. The other thing is there are many of these that are what the department and Mr. Brookings refers to as tip-over on licenses. When you use a percentage approach, you can go ahead and make non-resident muskox tags $35,000 a piece because we haven't sold one in 8 years. And you have a whole bunch of things like this where we sell 10 or 50 or 20. And so this thing needs to be looked at, and bless his heart, Representative Tallarico did, with respect to how many we sell before we jump into let's go to 100%, 50%, 20%. So what I would like to see you do is, and I won't get into gorgeous details here today. There are lots of them. I have more analysis for Representative Tallarico. I'll send as soon as I can. But you need, this is, should be the starting point for the discussion. As Mr. Beretta said, there are a lot of other avenues in this thing where we can also raise money without going off the ridiculous end and by having great big increases, assuming we're going to make more money. You're so close to it on the fishing side right now, and that's why this doesn't represent any more increases there. But you can do the same thing on the wildlife side. I'll give one example. Right now, most of the trapping licenses sold are sold as part of combos, like 8-to-1, and those combinations are not all going out in the field trapping. They are basically in sympathy and support with our stage trappers. And when you take away or you increase that multiple tag to the point where I can save the money that I would have put into supporting trapping by paying for hunting and fishing, they're going to lose that. That money is dedicated within the Fish and Game Fund for fur bearers, fur bearer research and management, and that money, I can almost guarantee you, will go down. So those are the type of issues that need to be considered as we move forward with this thing. But I do appreciate, once again, Representative Sadler, I do appreciate Representatives Tallarico, Munoz, and Keller for, you know, getting this out on the table where we can take a look at it. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Tinker. We're going to go to the Matsu LIO next. We've got Wayne Kubat, followed by Gary McCarthy. So, Wayne, if you can come to the microphone, give us your name for the record and your brief testimony.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Committee members, my name is Wayne Kubat. I have lived year-round in Alaska for 39 years, 31 in the Matsu Valley. I became a registered guide in 1986 and started my own guide business that same year. Almost all of the money my clients pay for their hunts is new money to Alaska and stays here. License fee increases will always be a tough sell. With falling oil revenues, I hope you will move this bill on with sufficient increases to adequately fund Alaska's wildlife management into the future. The $10 intensive management surcharge is a great idea. I'm disappointed not to see it in this final draft. The wildlife initiatives of the 90s stopped same-day airborne wolf hunting, and moose populations plummeted throughout the state. General moose seasons where I guide closed for several years. Rural residents of Squintna had to eat black bear meat instead of moose. I'm a resident hunter too. Even if resident licenses double, a 12-month license to hunt multiple species of some of the world's premier big game animals will still cost less than a 20-count box of 338 Winchester Magnum ammunition. What a bargain. As a longtime Alaskan guide, I support the concept of a minor percentage of non-resident hunters paying the bulk of our wildlife management. I think Alaska's wildlife and residents benefit from this arrangement. I can live with increasing non-resident tag fees, even up to 100%, if it results in effective game management. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kubat. Gary McCarthy, out of Chugiak.
Hi, Gary McCarthy from Chugiak. I moved to Alaska in 1972 with my family just in pursuing hunting and fishing, and I've been here since. And I really support increasing the fees more than the committee substitute did. Many of the testimony have pointed out to you. I'd like to give you one specific area rather than being redundant. I'm a sheep hunter, and I'm very passionate about sheep hunting, and it's been sad for me to see over the years the number and quality of the sheep go down. And what's happened is, and if you'll look at the Department of Fish and Game, just the department's hearings and looking at what's happening, they are reluctant to act on any of or many of the proposals that have been put forth in this last year. They're reluctant to act just because we don't have adequate scientific data to support what's going on with our sheep populations. And it's been interesting in just looking at retrospectively that what happened after the crash in oil prices in the end of the 80s is we saw almost all sheep studies eliminated. There was very little done. And fortunately now, because of Pittman-Robinson, the last few years we're starting to do that again. But I just hate to see that money go away and not see sound wildlife management just because we don't have the information.
Very good. Is that your conclusion then?
That is.
Great. Thank you very much, Gary. Let's go next to Kodiak, where we have Dick and Sam Rohrer. You gentlemen know the drill, so give us your name and your testimony. Big boom.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. My name is Dick Rohrer. Came to Alaska 50 years ago. Have been a year-round resident of Kodiak since 1969. Certainly support all the testimony you heard in chambers there from the coalition members and support their efforts and generally the dollar numbers that they've come up with. I'm especially concerned that resident fees should be higher than what the current bill in front of you indicates, and I would certainly support that. I am past 70 and slowing down a bit, but will continue as a resident hunter. And I have no hesitation to pay the higher fees. I think it's a good idea on the old timer license to take a look at that every 3 years. And in fact, if you were to do away with that entirely, you wouldn't get any concern from me. I'd be happy to pay it. My greatest concern in this whole funding issue is federal overreach. And Thor Stacey adequately addressed that. But if we don't have enough money statewide in our state budgets to properly fund management and population surveys, I can assure you the federal agencies are actively doing that, and they will take over management on federal lands. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dick. Sam Rohrer up next.
For the record, my name is Sam Rohrer. I'm in Kodiak. Thank you, committee members, for your time this afternoon. I'm a lifelong resident of Alaska. I have a Master Guides license, and I'm also president of the Alaska Professional Hunters Association, although for these comments, I'm just representing myself. As you know, I agree with most of what you've heard in the chambers as well today, and as a few people before have stated, we haven't had a license increase since 1993. This is long overdue. However, I'm not happy with the current version. It just doesn't go far enough, and I'm going to offer two suggestions. Number one, there's been an idea floated to do the $10 intensive management surcharge on all hunting licenses sold. That's a great idea, and I strongly encourage you to include that. And the second one, the current $5 increase for resident hunting license is just not enough. As a resident hunter myself who buys that license, I strongly feel that we need a substantive increase there, not just a token $5 increase. I'd recommend at least a $15 increase. And then think about this. That still means a non-resident hunting license is only $40. Wayne Kubat stole my thunder on this, but I've written out basically the exact same thing he said. Let's put this in perspective. A resident hunting license for $40 is still less money than you're going to pay for a single box of ammunition. That's not too much money. We can afford that. So thank you for your time, and I'm available if you have any questions.
Thank you, Sam. I'm not seeing any questions, so let's keep knocking them out. Let's go to the Kenai LIO. In Kenai, we have Mike Crawford, followed by Keith Baxter.
Hello, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the time to talk to you guys today about this. This has certainly been a big discussion amongst people.
Mike, I need your name for the record, sir. Mike?
I'm sorry. Mike Crawford, and I'm a board member of Safari Club International on the Kenai Peninsula.
Thank you.
And I'm also a member of the local Kenai Soldotna Fish and Game Advisory Committee, although I'm not speaking for them today. you know, as Mr. Grass or Mr. Somerville said, I agree with everything that they commented to you to save a little bit of time there. I think it's important that we take advantage of Pittman-Robertson funds. We shouldn't be leaving that money on the table. I feel that there's some comments also about the feds taking over with a weak fishing game because of lack of information. I think we need to keep fishing game informed. I'm certainly for responsible spending of the money, but I feel that most hunters and fishermen in the state are more than willing to pay their way. Non-resident fees, there's been some discussions. If you just go south to the closest state to us in Washington State, a goat, sheep, or moose tag is $1,652 for a non-resident. A deer tag is $531. A small game tag is $183. If you're going to go fishing in Washington State, you've got $84.50 for a freshwater license, $59.75 for a saltwater license, $35 for a shellfish license, $20.70 for a razor clam license, and it goes on and on with their fees. Montana, Idaho, same thing, much higher fees. I've hunted in those states, and when I go, I just know I'm going to pay some money. So I think the non-resident hunters that are coming up here, we're not asking for a lot. I don't think it's going to prevent them from coming or spending the money, and they certainly should help pay for the management of our wildlife and fish resources. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Crawford. Appreciate that. Keith Baxter.
Thank you, Vice Chair Sadler. This is Keith Baxter. I live in Soldotna, Alaska. I'm testifying today on behalf of the Kenai River Special Management Area Advisory Board to encourage that House Bill 137 be amended to include a statewide sockeye stamp. Currently, HB 137 proposes prudent increases to existing license fees, and we believe that the inclusion of a sockeye stamp in this bill would also be a prudent measure. In recent years, many anglers who previously targeted kings on the Kenai have now shifted their focus to sockeye and other parts of the river. This growing interest in the sockeye fishery presents management, habitat, and enforcement challenges that require funding to address. A statewide sockeye stamp would go a long way towards providing the needed funding to address these challenges. Our board believes adequate funding for the rehabilitation, enhancement, and development of our sport and personal use fisheries are essential to ensure their sustained health now and for generations to come. It is imperative that the vitality of Alaska's fisheries not be jeopardized by fiscal uncertainty in our state government, and it is our hope that a statewide sockeye stamp modeled closely after the existing Chinook stamp will provide a secure source of funding for these essential fisheries programs well into the future. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Baxter. Appreciate it. Going to Nancy Hillstrand in Homer, the Homer LIO. Nancy Hillstrand, please.
Yes, hello. My name is Nancy Hillstrand. I own a seafood processing plant in Homer. We've been a fisheries corporation for 51 years in Alaska, and we pay into the Dangle Johnson funding. I travel by boat, so I pay through my tax on gas to the conservation of fish. I purchase firearms and ammo. I pay into the Pittman-Robertson Fund. I also buy a migratory bird conservation stamp. But I actually do not harvest wildlife or fish. So what I'm proposing is that we have a license for those that do not harvest wildlife, and that it be an introductory type of a license that would be maybe $5. I know that doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a matter of time trying to curry the 670,000 people that come up to visit here in Alaska, and also the 200,000 people that are wildlife watchers in Alaska. Viewers bring $231 million of tax revenue into our state, city, and borough coffers. This is double the amount that harvesters bring, but they don't even have a license that they can buy. And I just think that having a license to buy, and then from there they could buy this decal if they choose. But the thing is to bring these people in, to diversify and to bring other users into the fold here that can maybe do something to help to match these Pittman-Robertson funds. We're missing a huge, huge segment of income derived from people that utilize wildlife, but they just don't harvest them. They photograph them. They make money with them. They guide people that like to view them, but they're not paying anything into the coffers. I think it's time that everyone does, but it has to be introductory because they've never had to. You know, we're spoiled. It's what it is. But there's 12,000 non-game species. The wildlife action plans, the state wildlife grants, they need matching funds. And if there's some way to design this so that we can keep common species common and prevent animals from reaching the endangered status, will indeed prevent federal oversight. And the people that are the birders, there's 18 million birders in the United States that travel. And they come up here, there's 512,000 actually here in Alaska. So when you look at some of these numbers, I've sent something to you through the LIO here and showed that wildlife viewers brought $2.7 billion in spending in Alaska. And, you know, with the amount of money that is being spent by them, you'd think that they could at least pay a $5 license fee and give them the ownership to be able to contribute to this and help in the time that we're having right now with the oil revenues going down. There's 72 million people in the United States that are wildlife watchers. It's a huge, huge group of people. And the thing is, I don't think they understand how this all works because they've never been given the opportunity to, you know, to be able to contribute to something as fine as wildlife management. The 700,000 people, or there's 900,000 people that are coming up on the cruise ships. 700,000 of those are coming up to view wildlife. So is there any way we can create some sort of a license, let them have a certificate that they get online, it won't cost the department anything. I've talked with the finance department, and I just think that we need to start realizing that we do have an elephant in the room, and it's the wildlife viewers, and if there's something that can be added at this time, I think it's, you know, it's just high time that we create something that designates a viewer license, and then from there they can buy this, the conservation decal. So thank you very much. I appreciate your all of this. I do agree that we have bargain basement fees that we have to raise, and I do also include the, I think the sockeye stamp is absolutely wonderful. 50 pounds of halibut is $1,250 in my plant. I mean, if you figure that in one fishing license, you know, I think it's time we charge everyone a little bit more and help them to match our funds. Thank you so very much. Bye.
Thank you, Ms. Hillstrom. Would you entertain a question from Representative Wilson?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how would you charge a tax for people who are viewing animals? Are you talking about, like, if they were in a tour-type setting? Or how? Or do you know of any state that does something like that? We're just trying to figure out what that would look like.
Ms. Hillstrom, did you hear the question okay?
Yes, I did. I'm sorry. Yes, many other states do have different programs. They use license plates, which are very popular and do make some money. They have badges. They have, you know, different licenses or decals or whatever. But the main thing is we have to market to this group of people. And if there's some way to be able to, because of our cruise ship industry, and some of the many, you know, this huge group of people that are coming to Alaska to view wildlife, I think we can figure out a way to attach some sort of a fee that can go into these programs. I hope I answered your question okay.
You did. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, thank you, Ms. Hillstrom. It is now 4 o'clock, and it's our intention to close the meeting at this point, so we're going to hold public testimony open on House Bill 137, and we'll bring it before us again for public hearing on Monday at 9 a.m. on the 13th of April. Our next formal House Finance meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, Saturday, April 11th at 1 p.m. We're going to continue public testimony on House Bill 148, the Medicaid expansion bill. And with that, thank you everyone for being here and staying here. We're adjourned at 4:02.